Okay, welcome to the Accessibility Online Webinar Series. It's a collaborative program between the ADA National Network and the U.S. Access Board. Today's session is Accessible Fitness Facilities and Exercise Equipment. Our moderator is Erlene Sesker from the U.S. Access Board. Erlene, you have the microphone.
Thank you, Claudia. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today, where we will be speaking of, as Claudia mentioned, we will be giving you information on the accessible fitness facilities and exercise equipment. We have two very knowledgeable speakers, presenters for you today. Most of you, I'm sure, have heard, if you've listened to any of our webinars before or seen any of the Access Board trainings, you are familiar with Bill Botten. He's an accessibility specialist here at the Access Board, and he's been here, I believe, more than 20 years now. So he's pretty knowledgeable about what he's talking about. In addition to this particular subject matter, he was one of the leads on actually writing the requirements for accessible exercise equipment and machines. And then we also have Shauna. Shauna has over 20 years of experience in research. And so she's going to be talking to you today about some of the research also in this area. Now, there's a lot more information. There's a lot more things that I could tell you about Shauna and about Bill. But so that we don't spend a lot of our time with the introduction and we can give you what you came here to hear today, I suggest if you'd like to know more about our speakers, feel free to go to Accessibility Online, and there are full bios there for both speakers. And at the end of the presentation, there will be a slide that will give you the contact information if you would like to contact either of our presenters for additional information. And with that, I will turn it over to your first presenter for today, which is Bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Today's agenda, as you see on slide number 13, we're going to talk about the application of the 2010 Standards for Accessible Design and the requirements for exercise facilities, fitness facilities. We're also going to talk about some of the common facility features. I pulled out some issues that we'll talk about, like restrooms. Some of the other things we'll talk about is some of the areas of sport activity or other things that are elements and spaces you might find at a fitness type facility. And Shauna's going to speak to us today about inclusive fitness equipment and the movement through ASTM and ResNA to establish standard specifications for what an accessible piece of exercise equipment is and how you would evaluate that and what features would you be looking for to include in your fitness facility that would enable persons with disabilities to have an environment where they could exercise and gain fitness. Next slide, please. Slide 14 talks about the types of facilities covered under two different laws. First, the Americans with Disabilities Act covers Title II and Title III for state and local government facilities and places of public accommodation. And the Architectural Barriers Act for federal facilities would also have these same requirements that I'll talk to you about. So it would cover things like health clubs, gyms, fitness facilities, even a personal training studio would be covered. Employee fitness facilities in a federal building, a state building, or a building that's privately held under Title III. It also covers fitness facilities connected to, say, a hotel or a motel or a resort, even an airport or a spa. And local recreation facilities like a YMCA would also be covered. Next slide. Let me first say before we go into the specific scoping requirements that are found in the 2010 Standard for Accessible Design, is that these facilities are so important. I'm a person with a disability. I use a wheelchair. I'm a paraplegic. And for me, exercise and the ability to have equipment that I could work out on with the muscle groups that I still have available to me allowed me to gain independence, allowed me to be the person that I am today, to achieve the things that I want to do, live independently, operate a motor vehicle, the personal issues of bathing, dressing independently. So for me personally, physical exercise has meant my independence. And for a lot of people with physical disabilities, it is a way out of the situation that you're in, an opportunity to gain back some of your physical health. But as most people, I'm sure, or everyone on this line knows that physical activity is the way to long health. And for persons with physical disabilities, it sometimes can be very difficult to find places that are accessible, but more importantly, that provide exercise equipment that one could actually use. So the scoping requirements in the 2010 ADA standards are found in Section 236, and they require that one of each type, and you can see in the slide we've circled a treadmill, we've circled an elliptical, we've circled a cycle or some type of pedaling device, and the requirement would be is one of each type of these equipment would be accessible. We received some pre-submitted questions, and one of those questions was, do the requirements apply to fitness equipment that are placed in outdoors or in a park? And they would apply. So we would look at the scoping requirement I've just talked about, one of each type, and one of each type in this park or outdoor setting would still be required. There's no exception in the rule that says that if it's outdoors, it doesn't apply. So the standard would apply to this type of exercise equipment, and the issues that I'm going to speak about would be applicable. Now, Shauna reminded me today before we got going that the ASTM has also come up with a standard specification called for unsupervised public use in outdoor fitness of outdoor fitness equipment, and that's ASTM F3101. And so the ASTM has come up with requirements for outdoor fitness equipment about the equipment itself. The issues that I'm going to talk about, clear floor space and other things, would still apply through the Americans with Disabilities Act or Architectural Barriers Act accessibility requirements. I also want to mention one that I neglected to talk about in the previous slide, and we also received a question about HOAs and whether a fitness facility that's part of a housing authority or a housing facility, a multifamily housing facility, would be required to comply with these requirements. And typically the answer would be no. It would be yes if they allow outside memberships, people that aren't part of this homeowners association, to come in and buy a membership and still use the gym. Then it would be open to the public under Title III and be required to comply with these. But if the fitness facility is only for those residents and members of that HOA and their guests, typically the fitness facility requirements would not be a requirement for them to have to follow. Next slide, please. Slide 16 talks about specific requirements for exercise equipment and machines that are found in the standard, and that is the technical requirements are found in Section 1004, and it requires that a clear floor space of 30 by 48 be provided at that one of each type of exercise equipment provided in the facility. Now, if the clear floor space is bordered on three sides, it would be treated as an alcove. And the alcove provision would require that if it's 24 inches deep, you'd have to go to 36 by 48 inches of clear floor space. That clear floor space needs to be positioned for transfer for use by an individual seated and using a wheelchair or mobility device. And so for each piece of equipment, that's going to be a different relationship to the equipment. But the idea is that if you were using a mobility device, that clear floor space would align with the seat, if there was a seat on this device, that you could transfer over onto. Not out in front, not perpendicular to where the seat is, but hopefully parallel with that seat. So positioned for use by an individual using a mobility device is how you'd put the relationship of that clear floor space. The clear floor space and ground space can also overlap more than one piece of equipment. So you could have, as the blue graphic shows on the left-hand side of slide 16, where you have a weight bench and you also have a treadmill sharing that same clear floor space. That clear floor space can be shared by more than one piece of equipment. Next slide, please. So in the 2010 ADA standards and the Architectural Barriers Act accessibility standards, there's no requirement to modify or change any of the machines to make them accessible. And that's where the discussion is going to continue later today with Shauna's presentation about what you can do to make sure that your equipment is inclusive and available and usable by people with disabilities. The standard says you don't have to modify the equipment and that the controls and operating mechanisms of that equipment do not have to comply with the closed fist, no tight pinching or grasping or twisting of the wrist. All of those operable part requirements, even the maximum force of 5 pounds per pressure, has been exempted from exercise equipment and machines in the 2010 standards. RESNA and ASTM have been working very hard to provide guidance on what an accessible piece of exercise or an inclusive piece of fitness equipment is. And in the rest of this presentation later, Shauna will be speaking about that. Next slide, please. Slide 18 talks about some of the other facilities, elements, or spaces that you might find in a fitness facility. And I thought it was important to talk about the area of sport activity because it seems like most fitness facilities will have some type of a racquetball court, a basketball court, maybe a volleyball court. And the requirement for areas of sport activity is defined here in this slide, that portion of the room or space where player practice of sports occurs. It requires an accessible route to each one. It doesn't require the surface to comply with firm, stable, and slip resistance, but it does require a route to the boundary of each area of sport activity, every single court. Next slide, please. Slide 19 talks about court sports, and we've received a lot of questions about court sports over the time, but if you had indoor tennis courts as part of this fitness facility, you would look to spread the nets far enough apart that a minimum route of 36 inches could get between the nets on a tennis court so that somebody could go back and forth from one side of the court to the other without having to go all the way around another court or some other area. So you have to directly connect both sides of the court. The photo on the right is showing a series of doors that enter racquetball courts. And one of the questions that we receive pretty regularly is about the door hardware for racquetball courts. As you can imagine, the racquetball court needs to be a pretty flat surface so that the ball doesn't carom off in a different direction and that the ball responds by not hitting something that's extended into that space. The requirements for door hardware and door maneuvering space would apply for both sides of a racquetball door. Okay, so the door space and maneuvering space and hardware would still need to comply with the accessibility requirements that you find for doors in section 404. Next slide, please. Slide 20 briefly is going to talk about swim pools. And swim pools are required to be accessible or provide an accessible means into the water based on the size of the swimming pool. So you measure the perimeter of the swimming pool, and based on that size, it tells you whether one way in or two ways in have to be provided for that swimming pool. So each pool would have to have either a lift or a sloped entry, as the pictures are shown here, the top one being a pool lift, the bottom one being a sloped entry. Those are the primary ways in. You have to choose one of them if you're less than 300 linear feet of pool wall. If you're greater than 300 linear feet of pool wall, you not only have the sloped entry or lift, but you also have an additional way to get in and out of that water. Typically, it's better to separate those. I advocate typically for either the sloped entry or lift, and then maybe pool stairs to help those that still can ambulate into the pool but need handrails. Next slide. Spas. If you have a hot tub or spa or a therapeutic type pool, you're also looking to provide a way into that, an accessible means of entry. And it requires that a transfer wall or transfer system be provided or a pool lift. And the photo here shows a pool lift with a leg extension piece on an above ground spa. So access is required to where they're clustered to provide 5% but no less than one of the spas in a cluster. This would also impact things like hot and cold water, submerge or plunge tanks. Typically treated as a spa, you'd have to have a way in to each one of that hot or cold water sponge or plunge pools if those are being provided at your fitness facility. slide 22. Soft-contained play structures or play areas are also required to comply, and you'd look at the play area requirements. The photo on the right is the front cover of our technical assistance guide for play areas. But again, access is required based on what you provide, one of each type at ground level, 50% of those elevated. If you have more than 20 elevated play components, a ramp is required to a portion of those 20 elevated play components. Slide 23. I thought I'd just briefly remind people that it's every single toilet room is required to comply, men's, women's. The only time that you don't have every single one of them comply is where you have portable units. Maybe a fitness facility was going to host some type of fun run or something like that, and they brought in a bunch of portable units that were they were going to put in the parking lot. 5% minimum have to be accessible. Make sure they're on an accessible route. The only time restrooms aren't all accessible is when they're clustered. And the photo is not, or the graphic is not showing a cluster. Okay, the cluster would be all the same type. Typically they're unisex, and where unisex restrooms are all provided in a very close proximity, only 50% of them would have to be accessible. But a men's and a women's and a unisex is not a cluster. Okay, it'd be a cluster is considered all the same type, all serving the same location. Slide 24. In bathing facilities, it requires one of these. So if you have a locker room with bathing facilities at your fitness facility, you have to provide in the men's and the women's either a transfer stall, a transfer shower stall, a roll-in shower, or a tub. It's your choice, but one of the three have to be provided. In most of the fitness facilities that I've gone into, they're using the transfer shower stall with a seat attached. And you see that figure I've attached here. It's a 36 by 36 inch absolute dimension with a clear floor space that's offset so someone can transfer over onto the seat. All those provisions are found in Chapter 6. All the plumbing, bathing, and toilet provisions are found in Chapter 6. Next slide. The only place currently, I shouldn't say the only, but the main place that a bench is currently required in the 2010 ADA Standards for Accessible Design or the Architectural Barriers Act is when they're in dressing, fitting, and locker rooms. Now, they are required also in detentional and correctional facilities, but typically they're in dressing, fitting, and locker rooms. And if you provide a bench in a dressing, fitting, and locker room, you have to provide an accessible bench. So access to at least 5% of each type of locker in each cluster have to be accessible. Here the difficult issue is the operating mechanism on a locker, but there's lots of ways to do that now, some real nice ways that you can provide an accessible locker with a locking mechanism that's still part of the operable parts. Clear floor space at the bench, clear floor space at the locker, operable parts of the locker itself, and that accessible bench needs to be in that area where the accessible lockers are. Next slide. So slide 26 talks about steam rooms or saunas. It does require them to be accessible. Clustered, 5%, no less than one. It does require a turning space to be within the room, and it does permit you to have removable benches that incorporate that 5-foot turning circle or T-shaped turn. The door cannot swing into the floor or ground space for the bench, so the door typically needs to swing out. Next slide. Slide 27 talks about the sales and service counters. This is one I think a lot of people miss. That counter when you come in the door is considered a sales or service counter with a height of 36 inches max. Remember, you can provide either a forward or a parallel approach. If you provide a forward approach, you have to provide knee and toe space. If you provide some type of glass or security glazing that's surrounded the individual behind the desk or counter, there has to be a way to facilitate voice communication. Next slide. And this is where I'm going to leave it for Shauna to continue forward, and she's going to talk to us about inclusive fitness standards and exercise equipment. Shauna?
Thanks, Bill. I'm Shauna Cream, and I work with Beneficial Designs. I'm the lead researcher on Dr. Jim Rimmer's project, the RERC on recreation technologies. And just a little bit about myself, like Bill shared, I actually have a mobility impairment as well. I have decreased strength and balance in my lower limbs. I walk with hiking sticks when I'm out and about in the real world. And I use fitness equipment every single day to maintain strength and balance that I have. So it's with personal interest and dedication that I get to chair the Resonance Standard Committee on Inclusive Fitness and that I get to be the technical editor of the ASPN Inclusive Fitness Standards. I think I can advance myself, correct? Yeah, okay. So for the fitness equipment and facility standards, our goal is to promote mainstream inclusive fitness environments within public facilities. We're looking at a universal design approach. This will get the most access to the youth, the elderly, a range of abilities, and those without disability as well. We're increasing health and social benefits for everyone by decreasing secondary health conditions, by increasing physical activity, and increasing social interaction opportunities. We'll also decrease costs for participation by allowing participation in mainstream public facilities and decrease health maintenance costs. And of course, kind of compliance with ADA Spirit. Okay, so slide 30. ADA covers the built environment, right? But if you're someone like me, you get parked, you get inside the public facility. What do you actually have access to? So here's how me and Bill and others might experience the public facility. We can't really negotiate safely around or on and off equipment. So what do? We give up exercise program or risk injury. These are what we're facing every day. So for treadmills, this is a pet peeve of mine. I walk on the treadmill 30 to 45 minutes every day. It's how I mainly get my aerobic exercise because I cannot negotiate over ground fast enough to get my heart rate up. But you'll notice that in public facilities, the design of these treadmill handrails are the flared shape, which is not grippable or functional during use. And it's imperative that I and other people can hold on and functionally stabilize ourselves while walking on the treadmill at 2.5 miles per hour, 3.5 miles per hour, whatever it is we can do to get our exercise. You may find that you struggle with balance issues in seating and trying to get on those narrow seats that are non-removable where you can't pull your wheelchair in to get your exercise from might be difficult for you. Slide 34. This is another personal pet peeve of mine. I can sit on the bike, we come up bike at the gym and pedal away for a good 30 minutes as long as there's pedal straps on them. And I don't know what happens to these pedal straps in public facilities. I'm actually convinced that they must sell for gold on Amazon.com or something because they're missing half the time. And with someone like me, it just means it's not useful. If you're a chair user, the handlebar is often out of your reach. And what happens in a lot of cases when you pull that pin is it free falls. If you're a chair user and you go into a public facility in a hotel or such, you're not going to have any cardio. You're not going to have any cardio opportunities. Forget it. So, staff trainers. They're almost non-existent in experience with disability in the programming environment and inclusive fitness in the public facilities. But we have hope because actually today inclusive fitness has a huge momentum. The Department of Justice put out a call for scoping in 2010. Obama addressed it with an ADA in 2012. And there was actually an Exercise and Fitness for All Act introduced in Congress in 2014. But there's a lack of specificity in current inclusive fitness requirements. So what makes fitness equipment layout programming accessible? What is the instruction package? So standards translate inclusive fitness requirements into practice. The standards are under development, and they'll provide a complete set of instructions. They'll provide objective specifications and test methods. Without these standards, no one in the fitness industry knows how to implement these laws and mandates to provide access for people with disability. The Resonance Standards Committee on Inclusive Fitness was founded to define a set of instructions for universal design inclusive fitness facilities. Under this standards committee, we're addressing layout to come into compliance with the U.S. Access Board That actually brings me back to an example. One of the questions that was asked about treadmills. So the 30 to 48 clear floor space layout would apply to one piece of each type of equipment. But then you have other criteria that are out there, such as for treadmills. The manufacturers actually require 20 inches on each side and then 79 inches behind the treadmill. And this is what the RESNA Standards Community Inclusive Fitness is looking at, all of these different criteria, how to bring them into harmonization and how to get the best practice out there. We're looking at scoping, specifying minimum type of each type of universal design inclusive fitness in the facility, requiring one wheelchair accessible aerobic piece of equipment at least. We're looking into validity and usability testing and third-party certification to keep everybody honest. We're looking at staff and trainers. What knowledge is already out there? There's stuff available through ACSM. There's documents available through UK's Inclusive Fitness Initiative. Ireland has the UNESCO program. We're looking at what's available and pulling it all together. We're looking at policies and changing attitudes and inclusive programming. And then an inclusive fitness symbol to tell people, look, here, you're going to find what you need, equipment, facilities, trainers that better meet your needs. Okay, slide 40. So this is what the group looks like. It's a group of experts across disciplines to create these standards. It's an international effort. We have consumers, caregivers, advocates. We have government, fitness facility, staff, trainers. We have, see if this works. We have research and development, test labs, testing assessment, and clinical experts on board. And I was just told to increase my volume, so I just tried it. It keeps the slider keeps going to the left, so hopefully that's better. Within this group, we have organizations such as the American Council on Exercise. We have the English Federation of Disability and Sport, which is the UK Inclusive Fitness Initiative. We have National Center on Accessibility. We have NICPAD on board. We have several manufacturers, several universities on board, and then, of course, the US Access Board. Slide 42. So this is an international, like I said, perspective going on here. So the UK Inclusive Fitness Initiative model already has a program implemented in Europe. They're looking at staff training, fitness equipment, accessible facilities, sports development, marketing, and engagement. They've developed an IFI mark within their arena to say that this fitness equipment and this facility is accredited. They have over 200 organizations involved and have accredited over 550 facilities and leisure centers. Ireland's just launching a UFIT program, and so we're looking to them to see what they're doing for their inclusivity plan. So for the certification part of it in the United States, we're looking towards Lakeshore Rec Tech Test Laboratory. And we want to develop this out of the University of Alabama, where Dr. Rimmer's program is. The RRC is housed there. We're looking to develop that as the state-of-the-art fitness facility center and to provide third-party validation of inclusive fitness facilities to evaluate buildings and space, layouts, the equipment that the manufacturers develop, does it really meet the standards? We're developing a third-party certification program for that, looking at staff trainers, programming, and policies. So for scoping, we responded to the call, to the DOJ's call, and recommended that for each type of equipment, at least one piece of equipment, or a minimum of 10% of the equipment, whichever is greater, meets the ASTM Universal Design Inclusive Fitness Standards. For example, if you have two treadmills, at least one of them must have these accessible criteria. If you have 20 treadmills, 10% would be two. Okay, on to slide 45. So the scoping basically looks at cycles, ellipticals, treadmills, ergometers, and strength equipment. So in ASTM, FO830 Fitness Product Standards Committee, that's where we're actually looking specifically at the equipment and what makes a piece of equipment accessible to those with impairments and or disabilities. This committee developed fitness equipment standards for mainstream equipment. They already have standards on the books. There's over 100 members. Cybex is there, Precor is there, Nautilus is there, Life Fitness is there. All the big manufacturers are at the playing table here. They actually founded a TAG group for inclusive fitness back in 2008. This is a group, a subset group of FO830, and it is comprised of users, disability advocates, manufacturers, test laboratories, and legal experts. And I've been participating in these meetings every 6 months since 2008 to develop these standards. Our first milestone was getting the general ASTM FO830 Universal Design Inclusive Fitness Standards published. We now have on the books, and you can go to ASTM.org and purchase them, F3021 and F3022, which is standard specification and test methods for universal design of fitness equipment for inclusive use by persons with functional limitations and impairments. These standards contain over 117 general requirements that are applicable to all fitness equipment. Along the way, we identified gaps in access needing further research. We're also developing equipment-specific requirements. So ASTM embraced us. Dawn from the UK showed up, a couple other big players in the arena showed up to the first ASTM meetings back in 2008, and they said, do your work here. And they have on the books already standards for elliptical, standards for strength equipment, standards for cycles, and standards for treadmills with requirements for mainstream equipment that you find in standard YMCAs today. They opened these up and let us put in additional requirements for accessibility. So how this works is if there's a requirement that goes across two or more standards, such as adjustment mechanisms, can't be left right-hand bias, you're going to find that in strength equipment, you're going to find that in treadmills. Those requirements went to the general standard that we just talked about in the last slide. If there's an additional requirement that's specific to a piece of equipment, such as treadmills should have a color coding across the belt so that when the treadmill is moving, you can see that it's moving, then that goes into the specific equipment requirement. As of today, the elliptical standards have been republished with the accessibility criteria in them. The strength equipment standards just passed balloting. So we're actually going to go work on those next week at ASTM in Toronto and get those ready for publication. The cycles and the treadmills, and the cycles include the ergometers at this point, they are still going through balloting. All right, so now I'm on slide 48. This TAG group for inclusive fitness, manufacturers are completely involved every step of the process. They're supportive in the universal design inclusive fitness equipment movement. This is demonstrated through their approval process through balloting, and they're incorporating the specifications, the universal design inclusive fitness specifications into their mainstream standards. There's a check and balance system in place. We educate the manufacturers on what the user needs and wants, and they educate us on what's technologically and financially feasible. All right, slide 49. So one of the things with the manufacturers is they wanted solid evidence that people with disabilities are actually using their equipment. When I first walked into those standards meetings back in 2008, and the way my gait is, they couldn't believe I was using a treadmill every day and didn't know if that was right or safe. And of course I said, well, I'm already using it every day at home and in fitness facilities and in this hotel here. So we actually got an expert in the area of vision impairment who I'll talk more about later, and she did some user testing. And so I'm going to show you little clips here. This is a cycle user. He's 89 years old and he's blind. You'll notice in the clips, and the clips will go fast, and we noticed yesterday during testing that they weren't always in sync. So I'm going to tell you up front, watch how this gentleman uses the handlebars for stability during his exercise and how the foot straps, toe straps, and heel straps could be beneficial to him. once he gets off of this piece of equipment, he actually is standing and talking to another gentleman. And you'll notice he's hanging on to the treadmill handlebars for stability. And this is normal for someone like me or him who has an impairment to reach out and grab onto anything we can for stability. Claudia, can you try to run this video?
Okay. I will push the video. It will open your default video player on your computer.
Yes, yeah, so it goes quick, but you can see he's hanging on to the stability bars, and there he is hanging on to a treadmill just while he's talking and answering some questions. Okay, so here are some examples, and I think this is fun and interesting stuff, but I won't bore you all with the actual numbers. They're all in the standards, but here's some examples of what types of requirements, the nuts and bolts of what we've been doing in the ASTM standards. We've set requirements for a walkthrough design for recumbent cycles. So the structure in the middle here shall be no higher than 125 mils. Slide 51, turning my volume back up. Okay, universal design inclusive fitness requirements have been set for seat dimensions, height, width, and depth. We've also looked at pedals and that they should be self-righting and have both heel and toe retention. All right, I'm going to show you another video, treadmill user. So this gentleman actually presents a lot like me with gait. He's post-stroke, he uses a cane, has decreased balance and strength, and uses the cane for stability during everyday walking. When you watch this video, note his difficulty on getting on and off the treadmill given the step-up height of the treadmill. It turns out that most treadmills can be anywhere from 8 to 10 inches to step up on, or even more, and it's really difficult when you have loss of strength and balance. And then, of course, I don't think the video shows directly, but you'll note he's definitely holding on to the handrails for stability during his exercise program. Claudia, can we try this video? There he goes, careful foot placement. Down off the treadmill. Okay, so for treadmills in the ASTM standards for fitness equipment, we've addressed the side handrails. They need to be functional for use during exercise. They have to have an optimized shape to facilitate grip, and they have to be non-slip in material. In those mainstream treadmills that are found in gyms today, I can't get a grip around those flared handrails. And if you've ever tried to hold on to them, the moment you start to perspire, your hands start slipping. So they're not functional at all. I actually asked in one of our club industry meetings where they have all the equipment on the floor, why are you designing them like that? And they said they look good. What else have we done here? We've provided minimum grip length and provided range and height criteria for the side handrails. We've also addressed maximum step-on height. The step-on height should be, we know that there's equipment out there that actually has step-on heights as low as 4 to 6 inches. We negotiated with the manufacturers and came to about 6.5 inches of step-on height. And like I said, many treadmills are up at 10 inches, which is really difficult if you don't have the strength and balance to do this. And again, we're seeing like the Lancer treadmill on the right. You can find that in rehab facilities, but not in your everyday public gyms. Okay, moving on to slide 56. Volume up again. So we've also addressed for treadmill safety stops. We've addressed Can you guys still hear me? I just got an error in the web.
Yes, so it was an issue with the phone, and I see the captioner has stopped as well. So if you could give me 1 second while we get that back set.
Hello, please enter your 6-digit conference code.
Captioner, are you able to hear me?
Hello, please enter your 6-digit conference code.
I apologize for the technical delay. There's an issue with the telephone, and I need to make sure that the access board is also back on the line. Erlene and Bill, can you hear us? Erlene, Bill? Okay. Now, Captioner, are you able to hear us? Okay, great. Captioner's back. So, Shauna, if you want to continue?
Sure. So, the other requirements that we have addressed for treadmills include safety stops, and basically where the location is and that they're reachable by a third party who might be exercising with the user. We've addressed minimum speeds. Treadmills shouldn't start at more than 0.5 miles per hour, and they should have maximum speed increase increments of 0.1 miles per hour. And then, of course, I've mentioned a couple times, we've addressed safety markings on the belt, that they should have this significant color value contrast in the adjacent surface so that you can see that the belt's moving. And this is for any person, elderly, a person with a cognitive impairment, or a user without a disability who's running quickly from one piece of equipment to the next. Super setting, you can do that all the time. Okay, slide 57. For ellipticals, we've addressed fixed handlebar requirements and for the standing ellipticals. And we have developed swivel seat requirements and foot support guard requirements for the seated ellipticals. All right, people's vision impairment. This was a big hole in accessibility criteria and getting the fitness equipment available and usable to people with vision impairment. We actually had to pull in an expert at this point. ASTM manufacturers rightly wanted data to demonstrate that these people are actually using their equipment and to justify their cost of retooling their consoles to make their consoles accessible to people with vision impairment. Dr. Jim Rimmer went out, got the best expert he could locate. Dr. Barstow joined our team, and she provided user testing and feedback, sat in at the ASTM meetings, and she strengthened access requirements for the vision impaired and blind beyond and above what we were even proposing to begin with. She has an IRB-approved study, is looking for 200 participants. She's got 88 to date, and they're giving her feedback in a mixed-method survey on the differences in council experience and preferences. And not surprising to any of us, it turns out that users with vision impairment want access to all features that the sighted have, including audio feedback and enhancing visibility and tactile features. I think you're going to have access to this PowerPoint. There's her link right there if anyone is interested in taking her survey. Please feel free to do so. So this is an interesting slide two. If you look down in the bottom corner here with the color contrasting, if you have sight, this is how you see a council. And if it's got good color contrasting, then if you have a vision impairment, the top view is how you might see it in this black gray scale. So F3021, F3022, the general requirements for all for accessibility of all fitness equipment now contain 28 audible feedback requirements due to Dr. Barstow's expertise. There's text-to-audio output for the function buttons such as start and stop, increase and decrease, grade resistance, and programming options. There's performance output requirements for text-to-audio for the status and summaries including heart rate, calories, time, etc. And like I said, there's the 70% color contrast, that color value contrast requirement, where buttons and start and stop must contrast 70% with their background. This in itself was its own research project. We actually had to develop at Beneficial Designs a method to test 70% color contrast because there was not a good, solid, economical, easy to use in-laboratory test. So we developed a method to measure luminance contrast using spot meter technology that's commonly used in the photography industry. It's low cost, manufacturers can perform the test themselves, and we actually went through a full-fledged ASPM interlaboratory study for repeatability and reproducibility. And these research papers are online available through ResNA, and if anyone's interested in knowing further about that, you can ask me afterwards or send me an email. Brings up another question, too, that we were asked before this webinar. Are the controls required to be accessible? And so there's a couple different kinds of controls. These controls on a council are defined as main controls. And we looked at main controls are quick start, start, stop, enter, increase or decrease resistance, speed, grade or incline, audio on off, emergency stops, or any other function button that's essential for the use of the equipment. There's not a lot of specificity in the requirements, but basically the standard says to allow easy access to the main controls from the primary exercise position. The controls on the council shall be located in a clear line of sight in front of the user with no physical obstruction to interfere with access. Then it goes on to left, right, hand bias and grouping and pairing with similar controls. Okay, moving on to slide 60. So for strength equipment, we looked at addressing seat and back support dimensions, start positions, hand grip storage, adjustment mechanisms, low start weights, and wheelchair warnings. So wheelchair user warnings. So again, for adjustment mechanisms, back to that question about controls, there's not a lot of specificity in the standard, but the standard does say adjustment mechanisms required for setup shall be visible in a clear line of sight to the user when approaching the equipment or from the primary exercise position. And that's all that's said about the location of that. Wheelchair user warnings. As you can imagine, sitting around the tables with these manufacturers, this was a big concern for them, that people were being encouraged to use their equipment from wheelchairs. Did wheelchair users know the maximum load tolerance of their device? Do they know the correct positions of exercise to make sure they're stable and safe? So we developed in conjunction with NICPAD, and this is available at www.nchpad.org, a poster, Be Safe, Guidelines for Use of Fitness Equipment for a Person Using Mobility Devices. And we outlined wheelchair stability, do's and don'ts, and we outlined how to calculate and know the maximum load that your chair can tolerate. So just generally, if your load is approved for a 300-pound user and you're 150 pounds, your backpack, you have to take that into consideration, and then you have to take into consideration how much loading you're adding when you're using these weights. And we're advocating that poster be put in every fitness facility that has accessible fitness equipment available. All right, so we've talked about the testing and the validity and third-party certification. So this is what we're proposing and what we started to prepare through the RERC, is that Lakeshore becomes the RecTech test lab. We're preparing to perform universal design inclusive fitness validity testing once the equipment is available. Now remember, a handful of standards is already published, but there's cycles and treadmills and strength that still needs to get published. Fitness equipment manufacturers are not going to start manufacturing equipment until they have a full instruction set. They don't want to go back and have to retool or redesign equipment once other standards come online. So we want to verify during our validity testing that the equipment that they produce and that they claim meets the ASPM, the Universal Design Inclusive Fitness Standards, actually does meet the standards. So we've created a data form and we've run through trial testing on Universal Design Cardio and Universal Design Strength equipment, the best that's out there today. And we've worked with the manufacturers, given them feedback. So we have this testing in place, this protocol in place. At Lakeshore, we also want to do usability testing. We want to make sure what we've been working on for the last 10 years really meets the user's needs. And we know that this is a really good cycle. We're going to do usability testing. We're going to get better ideas, more accessible criteria. We're going to go back to the ASPM meetings, tell the manufacturers we should insert this piece of criteria, maybe tweak this one. It's evolving. So we created subject usability data forms for treadmills and cycles based on the accessible criteria. We used a Likert scale to look at access, comfort, adjustability, start, stop, programming, etc. We developed a protocol for testing with 5 users, one had CP, one traumatic brain injury, one vision impairment, one stroke, and one had no impairment at all. We looked at 2 treadmills and 2 recumbent cycles. We chose a newer model versus an older model for this preliminary trial testing. And of course, because we're looking at testing subjects, we're applying for an IRB for this. So here's how the testing is going to go. We'll ask a question such as, how easy or difficult is it for you to put your foot on the pedal and keep it there during exercise? And the user will rank how easy or difficult it is to do that task. And if they rank 1, that means it's completely accessible to them. It meets all of the accessibility criteria, and it's a good design. So the goal for the recumbent bike in this question was, you should have heel and toe retention to keep that foot in place, to place the foot, to start exercising, and keep it in place during exercise. And you can see here with our the average of our 5 test subjects was that this one ranked 7 on the left that has the typical strap that you see in gym, and this one ranked 10, harder on the right. We did the same thing for treadmills, and so the sample question I'm showing you is, how easy or difficult was it to step up on the machine? And again, 1 would mean no problem at all, completely accessible. And the goal here was to reach that 170 mil or about 6.5 inch step up height. So you can see from the photograph here that the one on the left is a lower step up height design and the one on the right is higher. And the one on the left, as we would expect, ranked easier to use. Okay, we're on slide 67. So for that's a lot of information for the fitness equipment, and that's well underway and has been. That was actually part of our first RERC, first 5 years RERC, and we're now in the second 5 years RERC and working on these standards. And the ASPM standards were the main focus, the only focus of the first 5 years. So during this second 5 years, which now we're in year 5 of, we've really been focusing on the complete inclusive fitness environment. We've got information up and going. The ball's rolling for standards. We have, you know, the Department of Justice looking at the standards. We have Congress looking at the standards. We have the U.S. Access Board that's been intimately involved in developing the standards. So the policymakers know what's going on for the fitness equipment, and those standards are set to be published by the end of the year. hopefully, if everything is valid and goes okay. But what about staff and trainers and policies and programs beyond the fitness equipment? And that's what we're really looking at with the RESNA Standards Committee on Inclusive Fitness. And so we're considering what's currently available, what's out there in standards, guidelines, literature, and best practices. We've looked at ACSM, of course we've looked at the UK inclusive fitness packages, kits, and policies. We talked about UNESCO, what they're developing over in Ireland in their UFIT program. RESNA and the literature that's out there was published, like I mentioned, the color contrast study was published, and policy on inclusive fitness was studied, was published a paper on policy. And we've identified areas needing future work as well. Our goals in these policies is to consolidate best practices to increase access for people of all abilities and the aging. Enable benchmarking, action planning, and progress monitoring of accessibility. And to reframe the language and attitudes, use universal design, use inclusive, and ultimately just allow people with disabilities to identify centers, facilities that meet their needs. 69, slide 69. So this is the inclusive fitness symbol research that was done. We were asked by the equipment manufacturers, we were pleasantly surprised. One of the meetings, sitting around the table, and they had obviously several of the manufacturers had gone back to their facilities and done mock-ups of fitness equipment and had a lot of information to bring back to us of what was going to work and what wasn't working. And they said, well, if we develop this specialty piece of equipment, this new design type of equipment, we want a symbol on it that says, you know what, this piece of equipment meets the ASTM standards for accessibility. We want something that conveys access to people of all abilities. And we want it to have a positive connotation and not just indicate or have come across that it's just for use by people with disabilities. So if you think of the restroom international access sign and then the parking spot, right, a restroom, that international symbol for accessibility sign says anybody can go into that restroom and use it, whereas the parking spot sign, you must have a disability and a permit to use it. And we also talked about using this symbol in other environments, in other inclusive fitness environments, such as the facility as a whole can be get a symbol that it meets, you know, 95% of the access requirements of programming. You know, you go through this door, you're going to get accessible programming. And there's all kinds of uses that we're exploring. So again, we employed Dr. Barstow to run a survey, and this is the 9 symbols that were put out there for accessibility. We went through some pilot testing, and this is what we came up with. This was an IRB-approved survey that Dr. Barstow led. She had 825 participants, and she had international participation. It was a mixed method survey again. Symbol 4 was came out on top, had the best survey results for being the most understandable and the most user-friendly. So what we did is we took this research per the manufacturer's suggestion and needs and went back to them and said, this is the symbol that came out as the best. And so they opened back up the ASPM S3021 general requirement. We put the survey in there with a requirement that if you were going to use an inclusive fitness symbol on your equipment to say that it meets the S3021 requirement specification and test method, then this symbol needs to be this wide and in this location and have this kind of tactile input. And we put in several criteria for this symbol. It went through balloting, and it passed and is republished now with the symbol in it. And like I said, we're going to look at facilities and programming too. Any of this stuff that, any of these studies that I've talked about with Dr. Beth Barstow, you can feel free to contact her directly at bbarstow@uab.edu. And again, I'm sure this information is available to everybody. All right, so summarize, inclusive fitness standards. I've talked about two entities. I've talked about the ASTM international standards, and I've talked about the RASNA standards for inclusive fitness. That's right here developed in the U.S. The universal design is used through all standards to improve accessibility. Standards have a long-term impact on the fitness industry. They apply to public and private fitness centers. Standards enable policymakers to create policies and regulations. The U.S. Access Board can now refer to the standards. DOJ can now refer to the standards. They define requirements and increase objectivity of testing and evaluation through third-party certification. It creates instructions for providing full access fitness environments. It improves access to equipment through facility layout guidelines. It provides guidance on minimum equipment types and minimum percentages of universal design inclusive fitness equipment required in the facility. It defines a standard for what makes a piece of fitness equipment accessible. This allows manufacturers to design and build to a specific instruction set for their treadmills, ellipticals, cycles, and strength equipment. Increases the safety and quality of products by having a uniform set of standards across manufacturers. They're all using the same instruction set. It defines a set of guidelines for educating staff and trainers on inclusive fitness, how to help someone with an impairment and or disability, and how to promote a positive environment and attitudes and policies within their facilities. It removes barriers to participation in programming. It allows people like me to go to our public community gym and work out next to my husband and my children rather than having to go to a rehab center 20 miles away in downtown Santa Cruz, and which only I'm allowed access to. And then, of course, we looked extensively at the inclusive fitness symbol. So the outcomes that we're hoping to achieve that will enable people with functional limitations to identify fitness facilities, trainers, and equipment that meets their specific needs will allow people like me to participate in exercise with family and friends every day and have that community inclusion. It will assist the facility operators, trainers, and staff with creating an inclusive fitness facility transition plan. We're creating resources and culling information for inclusive fitness training, layout, equipment, and programming all in one place. And going to have a dissemination program so that you know where it's housed and you can come and see what's available and talk with us and give us feedback and we can give you feedback. And then, of course, create this Lakeshore Rec Test Laboratory. The RASNA Standards Arena and the ASTM Standards Arena and the U.S. Access Board have all been working very closely together. We're all committed to advocating for more than the minimum requirements. There's minimum requirements, as Bill talked about, in the layout, and then, like I talked about, for treadmills and specifically, we're looking about going above and beyond the minimum requirements. If you noticed in Bill's talk, he talked about the requirements on for access and how they can overlap a piece of equipment. And I don't have the graphic to bring it right back up, but if you notice, he said, okay, you could have a treadmill next to a piece of strength equipment, and they would share the shared clear space dimension so that someone can get on it and put their mobility device there and step onto, say, the treadmill or the strength equipment. That's a great first start. But what if there's two of us with, what if both Bill and I are both wanting to access to those pieces of equipment works out side by side? So we're in the RASNA IF environment are looking at expanding these requirements above and beyond the minimum requirements. And ASTM's been working with us with that too. The U.S. Access Board has been obviously critical to this work, participating in both arenas and providing critical feedback and just everything I've talked about today versus with policy and Department of Justice and the initiative that was proposed to Congress. The momentum's there, and we just need to keep it going and keep doing webinars and seminars like this and getting the information disseminated to the users and get users and fitness facilities to start asking for this equipment. It's basically where we are now. Okay, so at this point, and I know I've gone a little through a little quicker than you all had anticipated, but I'll turn it over to you, Arlene, and maybe we can have some discussion and questions.
Thank you, Shauna. Can everyone hear me? Okay. What we're going to do now, as Shauna said, we kind of went through it. We gave you a lot of information, but we have been receiving some very good questions during that time that we were giving you that information. So what I'm about to do now is to ask the questions to the presenters. Some specifically said directed to Bill, a few for Shauna, but when I pose the question, if either of you has more information to add to that answer, feel free to do so. Okay? And the first question we have has to do with the ASPM standard. When we talked about the outdoor equipment early on in the program and we talked about there being a standard for outdoor equipment, we have a question that asks, can we please state the specific ASPM rule regarding outdoor equipment?
This is Bill, and Shauna, please feel free to jump in. It's ASTM F3101, the standard specification for unsupervised public use of outdoor fitness equipment. That's the current standard specification issued through ASTM for outdoor fitness equipment. Remember that I stated that the 2010 Standards for Accessible Design and the Architectural Barriers Act, neither one of them exempt the equipment from being outdoors or indoors. It doesn't specify. And so the requirement would be currently that one of each type have an accessible route to it and a clear floor space positioned so that a person in a mobility device could transfer to it. This ASTM standard specification would do more of what like Shauna was talking about, and that is make sure that the equipment is inclusive and can provide an opportunity for persons with disabilities to use it by incorporating some of the ASTM requirements for seat height and straps on pedals, or if there's any type of display, the issues that Shauna was talking about, and even all the way to identifying that it is a inclusive piece of fitness equipment with a label or sign. Do you have anything to add, Shauna?
So, yes, that was a good overview. So, and just to go a little bit further, so remember, these standards are voluntary. And there is no policy right now that mandates that facilities have accessible equipment. We need to demand it from the users and the facility perspective at this point. So what this standard, what this outdoor fitness equipment standard does is it says if you should choose to have accessible fitness equipment in your playground or in your park area, in the outdoor environment, then you must meet the ASTM F3021 and F3022 general standard requirements that we just went through. And it also refers directly to Department of Justice as far as layout. Instead of talking about layout directly, it says you have to comply with the layout design that the Department of Justice mandates.
And so as Shauna stated, this is Bill again, as Shauna has stated that the ASTM requirements and RESNA requirements currently are voluntary, and it's important to understand that in order for them to become mandatory, it's something that you could require locally, it's something that you could require as part of a trade group, or it's going to take rulemaking from the Access Board and adoption by the Department of Justice or a standard-setting agency under the Architectural Barriers Act before these voluntary standards in ASTM would become mandatory. And I think both Sean and I have kind of expressed our personal beliefs and need for accessible equipment. It's one thing to provide a clear floor space next to a piece of equipment, but that doesn't always facilitate the use by a person with disabilities. And so I advocate that even though these standards are for equipment and voluntary at this time, to pressure your local groups or fitness facility to make sure that they're incorporating equipment that actually meets the needs of people with disabilities. Without that, people with disabilities typically are forced to go, as Shauna stated, to a rehabilitation center for their exercise, or purchase the equipment for themselves and make sure that the equipment they have at their home is accessible.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question, which gets more to where the exercise facility is located. So the question has to do about, they asked, what about facilities that are used by law enforcement, such as at a border station? Are these facilities required to be accessible?
They would be. There's not an exemption for police officers or that type of facility. This would be similar to a break room, any common or public use space. So exercise facilities within Customs or Border Patrol facilities would also be required to meet accessibility requirements. And if they're federal facilities, remember that they're, even work areas are required to be accessible. But this would be a public or common use area and would have to meet the minimum requirements of an accessible route to one of each type of piece of equipment and a clear floor space at that type of equipment that would be available for transfer from a mobility device by a person with a disability.
Okay. We have, this question is for you, Shauna, specifically, because we have someone who's very interested in the whole RESNA process, and they wanted to know from you if they wanted to participate or would like to get additional information, what would they need to do?
They can contact me. The RESNA Standards Committee, the RESNA Standards Committees are open to the public. People can sit in on any of the standards meetings. Bill, off the top of my head, I don't think we've scheduled our next one yet, right? For RESNA Standards Committee Inclusive Fitness. But it will be happening sometime.
It'll be in late summer.
Yeah, that's what I think we decided. Probably August, September. So if they email me and Shauna, S-E-A-N-N-A, at Beneficial Design, oneboardplural.com, then I can get them in touch with the information and keep them in the loop. They can also visit RESNA.org. All of our standards committees for RESNA are in there, and you'll see the RESNA icon is still there, too. Anyone's welcome to join, participate, be an observer, actually work on the standards. Those standards are under development right now.
And Shauna, also that Shauna's contact information will be on the next slide that we put up. All the contact information on that will be on there. Shauna, can you also speak about ASTM? ASTM, you have to become a member in order to participate in that. But do you want to speak any about the help that we need on any of the ASTM committees?
The ASTM committees, I don't chair them like I do the RESNA Standards Committee on Inclusive Fitness. So I have more of a say over the membership in the RESNA. ASTM, you go to ASTM.org, and I can also, if you're interested in participating on the equipment standards, I can also move there. That arena is pretty much filled with manufacturers. They pick up the most seats at the table. And anyone's welcome to come join. I don't think, honestly, that my group of memberships in FO 830 would have any qualms of anybody coming to observe, sit around the table to observe. Although it's in main ASTM, you do have to be a member of the ASTM to participate.
I'm a member of ASTM in several different areas, and I think it's very important that advocates for persons with disabilities and persons with disabilities participate in these, because as Shauna stated, a lot of these committees are manufacturer-driven, and in order for the standards to come out and actually meet the needs of people with disabilities, I think it's very important, as in all rulemaking that affects people with disabilities, that people participate and add their comments and make sure that these standards are developed in a way that they facilitate access by all people.
Okay. And then we had a couple of questions that were very similar, and they had to do with the statement Bill made about exercise facilities that are located at residential facilities. And so we had a couple questions about, well, one, both basically dealing with the Fair Housing Act, but one stating where does it actually state in what standard, what guideline, that if you have a residential facility that's only for the use of the residents and their guests, that it does not need to comply. And along the same vein, another questioner was asking, even if it's not required to comply per ADA, wouldn't the Fair Housing Act requirements require that all amenities be accessible?
So under the Americans with Disabilities Act issued by the Department of Justice, in their regulations, housing isn't one of those facilities that are specifically identified as needing to comply. And so that would be the exception that, since they're not specifically stated, they wouldn't have to comply with these requirements unless they became a place of public accommodation where they sold memberships or invited others besides someone that's a resident or their guests. If they opened up for competition, say a swimming pool, if they had it also at this HOA, if they had a swimming pool, if they opened that up to swim competitions where the public was invited, that would be considered now a place of public accommodation and would trigger it. Under the Fair Housing, it would require that at least one of these or a similar number would need to comply, so it would get you a accessible route to the space, but I don't believe that it would get you to one of each type of piece of equipment. If, say, a housing facility put their fitness facility at the second floor, they have now bought an elevator to that fitness room or fitness facility because it would require an accessible route. I don't believe it would require one of each type, but a lot of building codes do. If you went to ANSI, they've incorporated the accessibility requirements that you find in the ADA, and so I think the building code then would probably trigger and get you that one of each route to an accessible piece of exercise equipment. But under Fair Housing, it would require those commoner public use spaces to be on an accessible route. I just don't think that Fair Housing would get you two individual pieces of equipment, but local building codes or the ADA may.
Okay. We have another question here, and someone was wanting to know when these standards apply. For instance, is this only in new construction, if you're altering a fitness facility, or when you're purchasing new pieces of equipment, when would this standard actually apply?
That's a different answer for the different types of facilities. So under the Americans with Disabilities Act, it applies to new construction or alterations of existing. And so for Title III, if you were not accessible and you were an existing facility, it would be readily achievable barrier removal for Title III facilities. Under Title II, city, state, county, local facilities, you'd have the obligation of program access. And not all existing fitness facilities under program access may have to comply. If you can establish that you have that program and it is accessible, you may not have to alter all existing fitness facilities if you were a state, city, or county facility. Again, barrier removal for Title III, program accessibility for Title II. Both of those issues can be addressed by the Department of Justice, and they have some great technical assistance guidance on their website, or their technical assistance hotline could help you further there if you're an existing facility wondering about your obligation. Now, in a federal facility, there's not either one of those, program access or barrier removal under the Architectural Barriers Act. It's only when something is altered or newly constructed. And so for a federal facility, say, at the Ronald Reagan Building down here in Washington, D.C., where I'm located, we have a fitness facility available for federal employees, including Customs and Border Protection staff. And there would be no requirement to make that facility accessible if it wasn't already as an existing facility unless they altered it or constructed a new facility. So those would be the requirements of who needs to comply. New construction, alterations always need to comply under the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Architectural Barriers Act. For existing facilities under Title II, program access, and for Title III, it would be readily achievable barrier removal.
Okay. Well, Shauna, this one is for you. During your presentation, you said that you had identified more areas in need of work, and the question was, what are these areas?
There's several areas that need more work. One is, like I said, we need to do the usability testing and make sure that the ASTM standards actually meet user needs. These standards were developed on subjective, mostly usability testing done in the UK, and then input by experts and users via survey. So once the equipment comes offline, we'll need to conduct this usability testing and see, you know, where there's other deficits. Then there's deficits in the whole inclusive fitness environment. There's the trainers. There's programs at ACSM where trainers can get through, get training in training people with impairments or disabilities through the ASCSM program, but it's not being widely used, so why not, and how do we address that issue? There's layout, and like I said, there's problems there where the minimum requirements don't most adequately address the user needs who are working out together, multiple people with disabilities in the same facility. So those are the type of things that, yeah, we've noted that need further research.
Okay, thank you, Shauna. The next question, we're going to swimming pools now, and the question has to do with actual access into the water, and can two lifts to a pool be counted as providing two means of access into the water?
This is Bill again. Remember I stated that the means of access into a swimming pool is related to the perimeter of pool wall or the perimeter water sheet. And the requirement is that if you are greater than 300 linear feet of pool wall, you have to have two accessible means of entry. The standard was written so that you can duplicate a primary means of entry as a secondary means. So yes, you can have two pool lifts. The idea would be is that you put them on different pool walls. The issue there is that you're serving the same population. And so I don't advocate that you use two sloped entries or you use two pool lifts, because remember, we're trying to provide access to a wide variety of people with abilities. And so a pool lift might be great for someone that's using a mobility device that needs to transfer to get in and out of the water. A sloped entry or pool stairs might be better for somebody that is kind of afraid of the pool lift or maybe doesn't think the pool lift's for them, but they're okay with walking down a shallow ramp or stairs with handrails. So I advocate that you don't use the same type, but the standard does permit the primary means be duplicated in order to provide your two means of entry for swimming pools greater than 300 linear feet of pool wall. Okay, so you can do it. It's just you're not servicing a wider variety of population that might need a different way in. You might do a sloped entry and a pool lift. I think that would be good, or a pool lift or a sloped entry and then combination that with stairs. Personally, the transfer wall or the transfer system are a lot more work for to get in and out of. And even though they are permitted as a secondary means of entry, I think the pool stairs actually facilitate if you already provide a sloped entry or a lift for those using a mobility device.
Okay. Well, while we're talking about pool lifts, there's also a question, is the swimming pool lift allowed to be used for above-grade spas under the ADA regulations?
It is. We don't specify. I actually think and advocate in this one that above ground spas, you should do the transfer wall. It's easier to get in, but it's harder to get out. If you do the pool lift, sometimes the pool lift can be a challenge, but above grade pools or spas or even plunge pools can use a pool lift to provide an accessible means of access. The issue is that you really want someone that's riding this pool lift to be in long seating. That is with their legs straight out in front of them instead of bent, because if they're bent, then you have to go up even higher to get over that pool wall to submerge someone into it. And so it's really a leg extension piece to keep your legs in an outright or long sitting position on pool lifts that are above grade is really what's needed.
Okay. Shauna, we have a question just about the types of equipment that you've looked at, and are there still pieces of equipment that you have not looked at yet that would still need requirements written for them?
Yeah, good question. The general standard applies to all equipment out there. The UK has a set of standards, which they call their Inclusive Fitness Initiative Stage 2 standards. And these have been used for fitness equipment in the UK for 10 years now. And they had stage one, then they went to stage two. Then we started collaborating. We started seeing the holes in their standards, what we've met with ASTM and recovered there. If you look up the UK's Inclusive Fitness Initiative Stage 2 standards, there's other equipment that I didn't talk about, such as rowing machines, steppers, et cetera, that were addressed in our initial work. In the arena of ASTM, they only have standards on the books at the moment for cycles, treadmills, ellipticals, and strength equipment. So that's what we picked up on first as specific equipment standards to look at how we can make them more accessible. Our next steps would be to start looking at steppers and or rowing machines and other pieces of equipment that we haven't addressed specifically, although they all fall under the general requirements.
Okay. Now our next question has to do with what was shown on slide 25, and it had to do with benches and the backs for the benches. And so the question was, do benches have to have a back, or is only against the wall acceptable?
903 requires a back on the bench, and it'd be no higher than 2 inches off the seat of the bench. I honestly think the best way to do this is to put it against a wall or two walls, leave the long end and one short end open for transfer. But if you put it into a corner, it sometimes allows people to use the walls for stability. And instead of it being out in the middle of the room with a back on it, I think it sometimes can facilitate. I love it when the bench is within an arm's reach or a close proximity to the accessible lockers. One of the questions we also received was about hardware on accessible lockers. They make a pop open that's similar to like a garage door opener, to where when you hit the button electronically, the thing pops open. There are some combination locks now that are a larger domed front that are very abrasive or tactilely. You could do it with the side of your hand so you didn't have to tightly grasp or pinch. But look at some of the locker manufacturers. They've come up with some really good and accessible means of opening lockers.
Okay, we have time for one more question. And that question would be, someone pointed out, Bill, they were saying that during the presentation you said counters must be 36 inches, and they're wondering, didn't you mean 34 instead of 36?
Remember, sales and service counters are at 36 inches, and workspaces or work surfaces are required to be at 34, and 34 is the requirement for an area where you're expected to sit for a period of time and do work. Sales and service counters are permitted to have a forward or side approach and be 36 inches high and the same depth as a regular counter.
Okay. Well, now I would like to, if you have any additional questions, first of all, we received a lot of questions during this time, and so I am aware that we did not get to all of those. So what I would like to suggest, if there's anyone that would still like their questions answered, because they were some very good questions we received, feel free to send it to our TA box. And that information is there on the slide. And Bill will get back to you with a response. Or if it's something that we need Shauna for, we can, there's Shauna's information also there too. So if it was something that has to do with the research, here's the contact information for Shauna. Anything else that has to do with the actual ADA specifications, feel free to contact Bill. And either one of them or maybe both of them will get back to you. We did have along the same lines a question, and I'm just throwing this one in because it had more to do with contact information, and someone wanted to know, they were a fitness designer, and they wanted to know if they could have Bill's email address, if that was available, and that is, and his email address is botten, botten, at access, A-C-C-E-S-S, www.board.gov. So that's our contact, the contact information. And we want to thank you for participating in today's webinar. Our next session is scheduled for June 1st, and that will be for accessible dining surfaces and bars. So again, I would like to thank Shauna for joining us today and giving us such a wealth of information. And I'd like to thank everyone for being here with us today. And I will turn it back over to you, Claudia.
That concludes today's presentation.